Okay. Hey, let's have a meeting, huh? This is pretty good. I mean, we've made it like halfway through the convention now, so we're on the downhill slide here. It's looking up. We can do it. We can do this. Hey, my name's Jim, and I'm grateful to be a sexaholic, and I'll be your leader for this meeting. This meeting is on indirect and living amends. So, if you know any of you thought we were going to do NASCAR, that's in a different room. So, I wonder if y'all would join me in a moment of silence followed by a serenity prayer. Prayer. God.
Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
So in the spirit of the fifth tradition to carry the message, this session will be recorded. The recorder won't be turned off. If you don't wish to be recorded, you may participate by listening or by attending another session. We ask that those who choose to share step up to the microphone so that those who listen to the recording can follow the discussion. You can't really get too close to these things, as far as the recording people say. You know, the closer you are, the louder it is, the more they can do with it. Let's see. Essay purpose. Sexaholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop lusting and become sexually sober. There are no dues or fees for SA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. SA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. Our primary purpose is to stay sexually sober and help others to achieve sexual sobriety. Our panelists for this session are myself, Jim, John B., and Michael T. We're all from Asheville, North Carolina. Each of our panelists will share for a few minutes on the topic, and then we'll open the meeting for sharing or questions. Again, we ask that those who wish to share step up to the mic so that those who listen can hear it. And we ask you to be mindful of the time, to allow others a chance to share. And it's afternoon now, so there are only 45-minute meetings. It's like we went to a new time zone or something. So here's an on-deck chair. So whoever wants to share next, we can keep on going. Let's see. So indirect and living amends. I want to open with a little bit from the literature, just to kind of define those things and to get in the area of what we're talking about here. In the big book on page 83, let's see. I can't find what I was talking about. That's okay. We'll move on. Step into action, page 25. It says, when we could not contact people, or if by doing so we risked harming them or others, we made indirect amends. These usually consisted of taking positive action related to the harm we'd done while not directly involving the one we had harmed. Then a few pages later it says, in some cases we made direct amends. This category includes people we can't find, people we harmed who are anonymous, people we can't contact because they or someone else would be injured by that action, and people who've died. There are many ways to make indirect amends. For example, we can do community service for and or make anonymous donations to organizations that help people harmed in ways similar to the harm we've done. Or we can perform some service anonymously in an area of our community where we used to act out. It's important here that our amends be appropriate to the damage we caused. A one-time contribution might not be sufficient for years of abuse. We ask our higher power, our sponsor, and others for help in deciding how to make indirect amends appropriate to the person and the injury. And, you know, my own experience, one of the indirect amends I made was to my father. My perception was I was abused as a child. And I don't know if that's true or not, but that was how I saw it. And I was really angry and resentful at my dad until I got into recovery when I was 47. And I'd pretty much blamed him constantly to myself and also to anybody else that would listen for all the problems in my life. And when I got into recovery and started doing a fourth step, and, you know, resentments, and then this was a big one. This was like the one that I really couldn't let go of. Sort of like the 551 and 552, the lady that, in the big book, the lady that, she had one resentment that didn't respond to the treatment, as it said. And that was true for me. And when I sat down to do my eighth and ninth step, and my sponsor told me to write a letter. When I got into recovery, my dad had been dead for 13 years. And that really didn't matter, you know, whether he was alive or dead. He was the one. And I started writing my eighth step, and I tried to write a letter to this guy. And I would, it always start out, "Dear Dad, you know, I'm writing you now to, you know, talk about the harm I've done and to apologize and to own my..." And within a sentence or two, it would be U-S-O-B, blah, blah, blah. You know, I just could not go there. And I tried over and over and over again. I kept praying about it. I called my sponsor and talked to him, you know, and back and forth. And he was real supportive and directive, you know, and just keep trying. And I don't know whether it was the 15th draft or what, but it was somewhere up in there when it finally started happening. And I finally, God helped me see that. I mean, I could never really see that I'd made any mistakes in this relationship. I was just a little kid, but, you know, what could be the problem that I'd caused? And I began to see that, if nothing else, I'd carried a resentment for 30, 40 years. And that was, you know, part of my part. Another part, and as I began to see that, I began to see other things. I began to see that I was overly fragile and hypersensitive in that relationship, and that I was manipulative too. I could see my mom getting sympathetic to me, so I'd create chaos in their marriage by getting her pissed at him. And, you know, it was just, I began, even as a little kid, to create problems, to be manipulative, and to cause harm. So anyway, eventually this letter started coming out, and I began to be able to own my stuff. Well, he's been dead for a long time, so I didn't really know what to do with that. And I was directed to go to his grave and read the letter to him. And in addition, I was directed to pray about and to start getting some understanding about what I could do besides that in order to make up for this in my own mind. Because once I began to see my problem, then it started just accumulating onto the shame and guilt of me, you know. And that's where 8 and 9 is coming from, is to start clearing that stuff out. So in addition to going to his grave and reading that letter, which was a really moving and profound experience for me, to hang out in the rain, you know, and cold of the cemetery and stand there by myself and read and cry. And it was good. In addition to that, I began to tell my kids positive stories about my dad. All I had ever told, pretty much, were negative stories about my dad. And it's surprising that when I started looking, all kinds of cool things to tell him about this guy. And even in my recovery, you know, I've been able to share in pretty much detail about that problem and that relationship without putting him in a bad light, you know. And that's part of my amends to him. And I notice it when I'm talking about it. And that's what makes a difference to me. You know, it may not make any difference at all to him. I kind of like to think that it does, but it makes a huge difference to me. I began to try to have the kind of relationship with my siblings and my mother that I think he would like me to have with them. And with my kids too, the same kind of thing. Have the kind of relationships that their grandfather, if he'd ever known them, would want their father to have with them. And I stopped blaming and resenting him. You know, that was really what I'd been doing. I'd spent a lot of time and energy doing that, and I stopped. And, you know, when I was tempted, when I'd go back to that old behavior pattern, I'd just remind myself that I'd been granted forgiveness and that I didn't have to go there anymore and that, you know, that I had a choice today. That one day it had happened. I'd started trying to write that letter, and it worked. Excuse me. Let's see. So there's some other stuff, but we've only got 45 minutes, so I'm going to move on here. So next thing that this meeting's about is living amends. It's a little bit different than indirect amends, just a little different slant. Like same book, different chapter. In Step Into Action, again on 25, it says, in all cases, we were able to make living amends. As the 12 and 12 tells us, we consider how, with our newfound knowledge of ourselves, we may develop the best possible relations with every human being we know. And then 10 pages later, it says, an essential part of any amends is changing our behavior, what we call living amends. We go forward living a sober life and behaving well toward those who are in our life. We begin practicing a positive sobriety, taking the actions of love to improve our relations with others. We refrain from the behaviors that caused harm in the past. We take positive actions that we neglected to take, recognizing that if we'd done so before, we might not have needed to make amends. And the big book is instructive here, I think, because in the part of the big book that talks about 8 and 9, there are several little one-sentence instructions. You know, on 78 it says, we stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the result. 79, it says, we ask that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences. On 83, it says, we ask that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. And a little further down, it says, we should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble, without being servile or scraping. Chances are, if I'd been able to follow those four sentences, those instructions, I'd never have to make any amends anyway. So, you know, a lot of what living amends is turning it around and not being who I was. And really, that's the definition of amends. You know, if I amend a letter, I change it. If I amend my behavior, I change it. And, you know, I've heard some people say that the only real amends is living amends. Because, you know, there's kind of a common concept that amends means I apologize. And it's not true. You know, I've been saying I'm sorry all my life, and it's true, I am a sorry SOB, but that's different. That's different than making amends. So how do I change it, you know? I mean, in my marriage, I was a professional before, you know, I had SA retirement put upon me. And my wife was always kind of, you know, a support person. Now in our life, in recovery, her business is the primary one. I'm a support person. I do what I can to help. You know, there are times when I actually take specific action in the interest of our relationship when it's totally unnecessary and even random, you know. If I know she's struggling when she's out of town working and having a hard time, you know, either with her health or just with her motivation or whatever, I'll just call her up, you know, tell her some jokes, tell her to have a good time, don't worry about sales, it doesn't matter, just have fun. You know, just because it's what I should have been doing all along. You know, and I wasn't. Just the last thing I want to say is the last year or so I've had some reasonably major health challenges, and it came on me about a year ago, and last January it was really tough. My physical status was just decaying. You could almost watch it go. And I've generally in my life been really vigorous, and here I am turning into, you know, it's like a preview of when I'm going to be 80 with a walker. And it was weird because for about the first week of last January, the first week or 10 days of this, I didn't really notice what was going on, not my illness, but my change in attitude. And about 7 or 10 days into it, I noticed that I was just on purpose, being silly, having fun, making light of things. It was like my body was going really bad, and my mind was going really good. And, you know, frequently in the winter, I don't do very well. It's kind of dark, and I go with that. And last January, when I was getting really sick, I was having a lot of fun. We both work at home in separate places in the house, and I can't sit still very well, and so I'm always going in to visit her, and I'd pester her and say, how come you never visit me? And, you know, there was just this silliness going on, and when I noticed it, because I think God was doing it, when I noticed it after a week or so, I thought, yeah, this is cool, let's go with it, you know, and I never talked to her about it. Or specifically, but I just kept going with it and following that along, and it really had a positive result on our relationship. I mean, it was amazing how when I was putting just a lot of positive energy into it, we just actually, she told me later on when I think I shared it in a meeting, and she was there and she heard it and was like, whoa. She said that she really started getting worried at one point, because the only time that she could remember me being that positive in the past was the 3 weeks before disclosure. You know, so it was creating some anxiety for her. But, you know, we were able to talk in that month about some really kind of tough issues, And they weren't really tough issues because it was like they were on the context of this comedy rather than on the context of the old drama. So anyway, indirect and living amends. Thanks.
Hi, my name is John. I'm a sexaholic. Well, I'm certainly not an expert on amends. I'm more of an expert on harms, actually. But I've had a lot of opportunity for amends. And before I get into the details of my take on this living amends, I just need to give you a brief history of why I needed to worry about living amends. First of all, I came into recovery about 10 years ago, wasted 2 years just going to meetings and acting out, and then got a sponsor and started actually doing steps about 8 years ago, and was really enthusiastic about recovery and about doing the steps, and went through the steps, you know, 1 month at a time, basically, step one, step two, step three, step four. I knew I was coming to seven and eight, but I was figuring since I was so special, I'd get an exemption or something from my sponsor, and I had a good relationship with them, so I figured I'd get around that. So maybe go straight to 10 from 7 or something. I knew that when I got to 7 and 8, I was going to have problems. And the problems I was going to have, first of all, I had this, you know, the standard SA amends to make with sexual indiscretions and relationships and dishonesties, but besides that, I had this huge black hole to deal with. I grew up right across the Empire State Building on the Jersey side there. In the 1950s, they call it the Hoboken, Jersey City area, which is pretty rough in the 1950s. And so I belonged to a street gang, and there's a lot of street crime. And from the ages of 5 or 6 to my early 20s, I was on a crime spree, basically. We'd go into stores and just, you know, put stuff in our pockets at first when we were little kids, every day, for years. And then as we got older, we got into more serious, you know, felonies and serious crime where burglaries and stealing cars and vandalism and even extortion and, you know, serious stuff. And I was put away 4 or 5 times by the time I was 20 years old. So I had all this to deal with. And most of it was anonymous people. So I said to a recovery friend as I approached step 7, 8, 9, I said, how am I going to do this? These thousands of people, I don't even know who these people are. And he said to me, well, you're going to have to be a real generous person for the rest of your life. So I began to pick up on that, and what my sponsor talking about this indirect amends, and he told me, you know, this thing where you break your amends down into 4 groups, and, you know, the first group you want to do, the last group you're never going to do, and so it started to become doable for me, and this whole concept of living amends started to evolve with me, and I began to think maybe I could do this thing. So one of the first things I did, since I had all these people I had to pay back, and I didn't know who they were, I started giving my sponsor around Christmas time, for me, a large sum of money. For me, I don't have a lot of money, so a large sum of money is not a great deal of money. But for me, it was a large sum of money. I give it to him every Christmas with the understanding that he would give it away to people anonymously. And for me, this anonymous part was really important because, you know, my fantasy of giving away money, I would ride around on a white horse and give $100 bills out to women. So it was dangerous for me to be giving anything to anybody, particularly women. So I assigned that job to my sponsor, and he, with the understanding he would never tell me what he did with the money. That was our understanding. Because if I knew what he did with the money, you know, who knows what I would do with that information. So he did really good with that, but he had one slip. A couple of years ago at a meeting, he came in, and he was talking about being triggered by a woman in a book in a shoe store or Goodwill or something, and she needed to get a pair of shoes. She didn't have enough money. So he said he had some money in his pocket that was living amends money. I knew that was my money. And he said he gave it to this woman, and right away I became the white knight, you know, and she was Cinderella, and she was this beautiful woman who needed a pair of shoes, and I supplied the shoes. So just one slip was enough to keep me going for months, you know, on that. So that was one way I did living amends, and I continue to do that, and that works well for me. I have a few other, types of living amends that I do. If I'm walking down the street and a person asks me for money, if I have it, I give it to them. And my kids make fun of me. They say, Dad, he's going to go buy drugs. He's going to smoke cigarettes. I say, that's none of my business. Well, it's his business. It's his and God's business. My business is, like the guy said, to be generous for the rest of my life. So I do that. At every opportunity, I do that. If I can do it, I do it. Another thing I do, this may sound kind of trite, but it's kind of a big deal for me. Since I was out on the street as a teenager and as a young child, I was never home, and I wasn't much of a son to my mother or my father. And so my mother's getting older now. She's getting a little dementia, and she's got a lot of self-pity. She's struggling. And so I talk to her. I don't really talk to her. I listen on the telephone for long periods of time as she whines and complains, and I just listen. And I don't try to uplift her. I don't try to change her mind. I just listen. That's my job to do now as a son, as indirect and as living amends. I listen to my mother, regardless of what she's saying. I just listen. I back her up financially, too, but I don't do it directly. I do it through my sister, again, anonymously. Another thing is that since I wasn't home to do the dishes when I was a kid or to make my bed, now in my marriage, my wife is a mother, so I transfer the amends from my mother, who lives too far away, to my wife. She's a mother with children. My mother was a mother with a mother with children. So I do most of the housework and most of the cooking in my house. Again, the anonymous thing is extremely important to me. At first, I would do it when she was home, right in front of her. I'd be busy cleaning the house, you know, because I wanted extra credit for it, you know. It wasn't enough that I get the men's for. I needed some extra credit. And when in my addiction, the extra credit would be sex, you know. I manipulated my amends. So I realized after a while I had to do that anonymously, too. So when she leaves the house, I do the housework, and I don't say anything about it. And she knows it's being done, the house is being cleaned, but no one ever says anything about it. And when I'm cooking, naturally I'm cooking. She knows I cook. But again, I try to keep it as anonymous as possible, because with my mind, I got to keep it anonymous. Another thing I do is my father, a lot like Jim. My father was the oldest son in a large Italian family. And the oldest son in a large Italian family is the godfather figure, you know. And these guys get fear and respect mixed up a lot. You know, they want what they call respect. What they really want is people to fear them. And my father was a tyrant in that respect. So my brothers and sisters didn't like him. My mother didn't like him. So when he's been dead a long time now, when his name comes up around the family gathering, it's usually very negative. And so I do, like Jim, I try to uplift the memory of my father by saying nice things about him, whatever I can find. But one thing I do anonymously is really neat. He was a Catholic. And the Catholics, you know, since the Middle Ages, I've got this stuff that you do. You can pay money to get people moved out of one place into another, you know, from purgatory to heaven or whatever. So you can buy people, you know, some freedom. So Catholics still do that to some degree. It's not like it was in the Middle Ages by any regard. So hoping not offending anyone here. I'm sorry. I have a friend in New Jersey who I send money to. And on my father's birthday and on Father's Day, they go and do this thing where you light candles and you pay the church and you do the whole thing. But I don't tell my family I'm doing that. Because, again, it's anonymous. If I was to tell my family, then I'd be the guy that's taking care of my father and the whole thing. You know, I can't do that. So, again, I try to keep it anonymous as possible. I try to be as generous as possible with friends and family. If we go out, I try to pay for the meals. My children and their friends, I take them out for dinner. I pay for the meals. So I'm the guy usually paying for things because I owe a lot of people a lot of money. I don't know who these people are, so I'd be continually kind of. And you know, what I find is, if I, it's like giving is like receiving. It's like if I'm putting it out here, if for some reason it comes in here, and I never did wind up, you know, short of money as long as I'm using it to do living amends. So it works out really good. And then there's animals, you know. I won't go into details, but I was really cruel to animals. If there was a cat with a tail and down there, but it was a tourist usually. So, so what I do is, and I also was involved in medical research, and where we use animals and cats and dogs for medical research. So one of the things I do is I do a lot of writing. I've written magazine articles about animal rights. I've been involved with PETA, which is People for Ethical Treatment of Animals. I get involved with them. And I do some kind of cute around the neighborhood. I buy bags of food for neighbors' dogs. They just deliver it, and they feed it to their dog, you know. So those are all the ways I do living amends. My sponsor's got a real good sense of humor. He says, when you get in there, he says, tell these people one of the ways to make living amends to dead people is to write them a check. I'll pass it on. It's a real cheap, economical way to make amends to people. He said, maybe you have to bury it, you know. So thanks. So thanks for letting me share.
Hi, Michael, and I'm a grateful, recovering sex addict and love addict. And I'm from Asheville, and my sponsor said to me, you know, you could be on this panel over here. And when my sponsor speaks, he tells me he's God, so I said, all right, so here I am. And so some living amends that I do. One of them is when I was in college, I went to college, and I was just about done with my degree, and I had to take I needed one more course, and it was an undergraduate course I naturally had to take, but they didn't have it, so they had a graduate course that was similar. So they said, well, you can take that, that'll work. And I said, okay, then that means since I'm getting undergraduate credit, I should pay undergraduate price for that course. They said, no, I mean, this is what the course costs. And I said, well, then I should also get graduate credit for it, too. And they said, no. And being, about 20 years away from even knowing that I was a sex addict, this was back, I was 23 years old. I became very resentful about that. I said, you know, fine, okay, that's the deal. And then every year after I graduated from that college, when somebody would call me from that college and ask for money, I took a lot of joy. And yes, I used to get a lot of joy out of my resentments. I'd take a lot of joy and just tell them, no thank you, blam, you know, like that. And I did that for year after year after year after year. Boy, I hate to say it, probably about 30 years, even after I got into recovery for about 8 or 9 years, I did that. And two things happened. My brother, who had graduated from the same college that I did, I told him the story, and he said, you mean you're still hanging on to that after 30 years? I mean, it was like maybe $5 or $10 or something like that. That's all it was. That's all it was. And I thought, oh, kind of like that. And so the next year rolls around and somebody calls, and I think it was a junior or senior from the college, and they called, and I'm a hard-headed person. I'm not like y'all here, but so same deal, bang. 2-3 minutes later, she called me back. And she was very nice about it, and I guess she had a certain amount of courage, or maybe there was an addict in her family or something, I don't know. And I don't even remember what she said. But from that year on, I give money to that college. Not a hell of a lot of money. They're not going to, it's not going to be an alumni building in my name or anything like that. But I give money every year. This last year, not as much. Things are a little tight. But every year, I give them money. So I do that. That's a living amends. Here's the living amends. I'm still working on getting my amends right to my wife. And this is about my fourth time through the steps. I don't know. I don't know how many times I've been through it. And every time, I discover new things. Anyhow, this is amends to my wife. But this is part of it. And being in Essanon and sort of knowing the deal, she gave me this article. It was Dear Abby or Dear Somebody or something like that. All right, there's this guy, and he writes, and he says, Dear, I'll say Abby, and I have this problem. I'm always supposed to be faithful to my wife, but these women always keep flirting with me, and it just keeps happening over and over and over again. And, it really bothers me, and, what should I do about it? And so Abby says, Dear sir, if this is happening over and over and over again, you're putting out some signals there. It isn't just a one-sided thing here. If this is happening over and over and over again, then something's going on. You're putting out some signals there, and so you need to do something about that. So she handed it to me, and I thought, geez, that's pretty good. That's me, you know. Not you, that's me. Why are y'all so quiet? It's about me. And so what I do is we make commitments to our marriage every day to each other. And I do about three or four things, and she says, you know, and I will love you today. And on some days she says, well, I'll try to love you today. And other days, you know, she just sort of look at me. But she's sort of new in the program, but that's all right. That's where she's at. But I make this commitment that I will wear this neon sign that says, I'm taken. And it really works. I sort of have trouble with it because I don't quite have it, you know, down. Maybe sometimes I'm even pushing people away nonverbally, and I don't want to do that. But I want to make it clear that, you know, I'm married and I'm taken and I'm committed to my marriage. And so that's 11 amends. And I think I'm just going to move on to one indirect amends. Oh, Mama, what should I do? Well, I'll cry again, but that's all right. Not a problem. I'm getting very used to it, actually. I was in a seminary for 3 years, and there was this one priest in the seminary that I just did not like. You know, he was affected, and his emotions went up and down, and, you know, of course, it was a funny thing. Again, I was like 21 back then, and it was a funny thing. Other people got along with him, didn't have a problem. I had a problem with him. If you spot it, you got it. You know, I learned that later on. Anyhow, you know, I probably wasn't very nice to this guy. Again, I would, you know, look good and all that, but, I didn't like the guy at all. So we're up in Cleveland, Ohio. My wife's uncle's going to be going to a nursing home. We're up there cleaning out his apartment, getting things ready for that. Picked up a Cleveland Plain dealer. Well, I told you I was going to cry. Looked on the obituary page. I never look at the obituaries. He's on the obituary page. He died. They probably ran the thing maybe 1 or 2 days or something like that. Scott's saying, okay, you need to make an amends here. So I did. He said, you know, in lieu of flowers, send money to Cleveland homeless or something like that. So I'm not very rich either, but for me, it was a sizable check, and I wrote a letter and said something about, you know, thanks for teaching me about forgiveness, you know, how to forgive, something along that line. And I did. I learned, you know, how to forgive myself, how to forgive him. A lot of stuff. I visited my mom and dad's grave. My sponsor's big on that. So I visited my father's grave. It's in Cleveland, Ohio. It was in December. It was snowing. It was sleeting. It was awful. I had these letters. Checked them out with my sponsor. Nice letter. Found the lot where they were buried. Could not find the exact graves because there's some little thing on there, and it was all covered with sleet and snow, and, you know, I spent probably 15 minutes out there going around trying to find. Anyhow, I read them. I'm sure they got the message, and, you know, like for my mom, indirect amends for her, I get her a card for Mother's Day, I get her a birthday card, things like that. Y'all, if you start messing around with this thing, this is what I'm figuring out. What this whole thing is about. You know, your heart's going to change. If you don't want your heart, you know, if you don't want your heart to change, then don't do this stuff. Thank you.
Okay, we still got some time for other people to share. And just one caution, because the reason I'm leading this meeting is because my sponsor is on the conference committee, and he sent out an email to me and some other people and said, hey, if you got any other good topics that you want to hear at the meeting, you know, I'm looking for topics. And so I sent in this one because I love to hear when people do creative living and indirect amends. And he said, great, you can lead it. So be careful. But anyway, here's an on-deck circle and here's a mic. Go for it.
I'm Paul. I'm a grateful recovering sexaholic from Murfreesboro. And I think what I want to share is mistakes. Back in my college days, I had a good friend whose sister came to college, and she had been in an abusive marriage at 17, and that was easy pickings for me. And I didn't treat her very nice for the next few years, and knew that someday the day would come and I'd have to make an amends, and not sure how that would work out, because I'd have to talk to my wife about that, and we haven't really dove into that. But what I found out was that she had passed away and from alcohol. And I knew she had issues when I met her back in college. So I wrote a letter to my friend that I haven't seen in 30 years and proceeded to tell him a little bit about how I was sorry, how I abused his sister and treated her and abused our friendship. But I didn't talk to my sponsor. And I thought it was the greatest thing that I could do, sending this testimonial letter about me to him immediately after she had passed away. So for all I know, they received the letter before they had even buried her. That was truly a huge mistake. And one of the things that I'm finally starting to learn is as you walk through the path of amends, listen to your sponsor. Don't go ahead and self-sponsor yourself. And you might have to take it to the grand sponsor, because I was great at sabotaging my own life and everyone else's. So through this, I'm learning not to do that. Thanks.
Thank you.
John H., a recovering sexaholic. Sobriety date is June 12th of 97 with myself, with women that I did for 27 years. It's August 6th of 1991. And that's when I got into therapy. I went to a Sabbath program, and the last speaker here talking about a heart. And in that program, you draw your figure on the ground, you know, and then you fill it in. Someone helps draws a figure, and then you draw a picture of yourself. Well, I had a block of ice in my head, a block of ice in my heart, and a block of ice on my groin area. But it was weeping, which meant that something was going on. And I think I still have a frozen heart. But the program has really made me aware. And one of them is, I have a daughter that I have never admitted is my daughter. I saw the child for 10 years, but I never admitted out of fear. So frightful of the consequences if they found out and I admitted it, that I'd be thrown in jail, God knows what. But that's been it. It's only now. You know, this happened in 19, she was born in 81. And I find out in 2001, some kid that I sponsored and talked to and knew said, I'm going to marry your daughter. And, oh, shit, I didn't know that. You know, I did, but I wouldn't admit it. So that type of thing, that's what I'm at now. I've written about five letters with my sponsor being on step 9, and I've done it three or four times. But this time, he says, how have you harmed that daughter or the persons that you're going to make amends to? And it's only by writing the letters, as I've heard here, you know, and I haven't got up to 15 yet, but I have one with a sponsor, and he helped me to put things together to help me realize. Now, I may not ever be able to send it. I'm not supposed to have any contact with the person. You know, but then that's hard. But that's one idea. Now that I'm aware of that, you know. And the idea of the manipulation with women, I think I had the same thing where a therapist said when I was at a conference, and he says, you throw out vibes. Like you pick up the plates after the meal, you know, at a conference, or just look and see. And that seems to be a trigger for some persons. They get to like me, you know. And that's what my addiction is. I'm looking for warmth, understanding, and affirmation, and I thought it was through relationships with women. Well, I wasn't really in relationships. I was just using these people. And that's where I have to work on my men's. And as I do, my heart gets more and more like it pulsates. Thank you.
My name's Mitch. I'm a sexaholic.
Mitch.
I ditto and agree that this is the step where the heart changes. It's the step where the promises start to come true. And it took me such a long time to really give a good working of this step. I wanted to report back. I actually gave a talk on this step in Nashville here about, I don't know, 4 years ago or something. And the idea between indirect amends and direct amends, and when should you make direct amends? When should you make indirect amends? And again, I ditto that the sponsorship is very important to help discern these things. I was really feeling like I needed a lot of help at this last time I went around through the steps. I had a lot of sponsorship. I had five sponsors, and in going through this, the steps up to this step, I found that all the feedback I got on all the steps prior to this step was all very complimentary. It was, there was a lot of good work to be done on all the steps. But once I got to this step 8 and 9, there was a lot of differences on should you make a direct amend, should you make an indirect amend, how do you make the amend, and all that kind of thing, given certain things. So the point I'm trying to make is, in making, I need to give a good effort at making this step, and I need to talk to sponsorship on it. But I always need to consult sponsorship. But at the same time, on a lot of these matters, there is no right or wrong. I mean, God is in the middle of these steps. What's important is as I make the effort, and it just causes me to go much. This is where the change happens. This is where I go deeper. I mean, the fourth step change happened there. The fifth step, a little bit more. 6 and 7. But boy, when I have to contemplate facing the people I've harmed, and really go deep and really get clean about what my side is and what I need to change and what I need to forgive, this step is the step to do it. So I wanted to report back at that conference where I gave a talk on this step. I was trying to discern whether I should make a direct amend or an indirect amend to some girls I had exposed myself to when I was like 12 years old or so, and I consulted my sponsors on this, and three out of them said don't make a direct amend. You know, you might scare them a lot. Might really be intimidating. And one of my sponsors said, you know, I think you can make a direct amend on this because you were young. It was a childhood thing. And I ultimately decided not to make the direct amend because I figured 3 out of 4. But then my last sponsor said, why don't you come and ask? You're going to be giving a talk at this at the Nashville convention, and he said consult the fellowship. So I consulted the fellowship, and all of you came up to me after my talk and gave me a lot of good feedback on what to do. So I'm reporting back. I ultimately decided to make a direct amend, and called these girls up and through their parents. First contacted their parents, and said I'm just trying to change my life, and I harmed your daughters when I was very young, and would you be willing to have them give me a call back? And the parent was gracious, said yes, and one of the daughters called back, and I just said, no, I'm sorry for the harm I did to you when we were children. And she said, Mitch, you didn't cause any harm. How are you doing? You know. And you know, we had a great talk, and the grace and forgiveness that I felt from her, you know, it was God's grace and forgiveness. And you know, this step opens up to forgiveness, so I can start forgiving him and loving others. And I did ask this sister if her sister or brother wanted to call me, and she said, no, I don't think they want to call you, because I'd done the same harm to them. So I let it go. There's no, you know, of course, no problem. But anyway, that's my experience. Thanks.
Hi, group. I'm John. I'm a sexaholic. Grateful to be here this afternoon. I need to qualify very briefly. I'm powerless over lust. My acting out has taken the form of compulsive masturbation using fantasy, euphoric recall, and internet pornography. I've dated women for sex, including married women. And I objectified women and used them to make me feel better about myself. Currently working step 9 and grateful to have been sober in this fellowship since February 1st of 2004. I'm really grateful for this session. I hadn't shared yet at this meeting and at this conference, I should say, and my friend who's here with me suggested I do so. I've been feeling a little bit out of it, so I'm not really doing this under protest, but I am a little. Anyway, I appreciate earlier comments about amends to animals. I was very apprehensive about this step, and my sponsor suggested taking an indirect amend first. And we had agreed, the backstory is when I was in high school, in order to feel powerful and in control of things going on in my life, I would go out in the desert where I grew up and shoot rabbits. Not for food, just to shoot them. In hindsight, I'd carried that shame around with me for quite some time, and so my sponsor said, all right, what would you like to do? And I suggested a donation to the County Humane Society where I grew up. And he said, that sounds like a great idea. He proofread my letter. He okayed it. I sent off the check. And my understanding was the amends is done as soon as the letter hits the bottom of the mailbox, that my job is over. And so I was surprised 2 weeks later when I received a letter from this same Humane Society. And I was also a little scared, and I didn't quite know what to do. So I prayed. I opened it up. Initially I thought they would use this check to buy office supplies or something they need, because I figured, well, they probably don't have a lot of stuff, and they have a desperate need in some way or another. They'll use it the best way they see fit. Well, I opened the letter, and it was a very gracious letter from the director of the Humane Society that said two things in particular. One was that they were going to use the funds, they were going to put the money into a fund that they use to treat animals whose illness or injuries are so severe, or they're just strays, and there's no money to pay for their care. And that was, I see that as a power greater than myself working right there. And lastly, the letter said, we thank you for your generous donation, and we sure hope that this helps you go a long way toward forgiving yourself for your past actions. And for me, that made doing subsequent amends that much easier. It was a great experience. I just thought I'd like to share that. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. We're out of time. Just to remind you that anything you've heard at this meeting is strictly the opinion of the individual participant. The principles of SA are found in our 12 steps and 12 traditions. So please grab somebody's hand. Let's close with the third step prayer. Third step. God.
I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt, to relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, grant victory over them, may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Amen.
Keep coming back. It works.
Could I have your attention before you take off? There's going to be mass tonight at 8 o'clock in this room for us Catholics. So please be there.
Tell all the Catholics you know.
Pardon me?
Tell all the Catholics you know.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, tell all the Catholics you know.
Great job.
Oh, thank you.
Great panel. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good.
I got a lot out of it.
Good. Cool. No, I like it. I mean, I've always liked that topic. You know? I wish they'd been on. I mean, look, there's some real spoiling things out here that have happened. The last story about the rabbit. I love it. Oh, it comes out of nowhere.
Yeah. You're not the guy that
Well, in creativity, it's not just women who practice on TV.
Thank you.
Sure,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
You guys did a great job.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, I'm sure.
My sponsor
will say to me,
you.
I don't understand that. I don't know how to do it. So therefore, how do you do it?
I don't know
what that means.
Now, Alan and Ethan are real big on it. You know, and I don't know if you're a double winner.
You know, the more I hear of SCI, I'm even questioning do I belong more in there than I belong in here. I mean, you know.
Well, my take on Matthew, this is just
I'll listen.
My take on Matthew is that I see sex addiction or sex psychology as a spectrum. And way down on the one end are the people that just get lines, big numbers.
For me, I'm an anorexic.
And then there's the other ones on the other end that are totally relationship focused, and they belong in Essence, you know, or Alan or something, because they're relationship addicted. You know? So they're not addicted to a behavior so much. And then there's, I think, they're in the middle. That, like, the agonizing, long, you know, multi-year-long, sexualized relationships that they couldn't get out of, and, you know, it's all these. And that kind of relational energy, sexuality. It says in our problem, relationship dependency, more fantasy, you know, and that's a relationship dependency. Those people, I'm one of them, benefit a lot from doing SA and doing LN or SN or something like that.
Yeah, but I'm thinking, you see, for me, I'm sexually anorexic. I was afraid of men and women because I was abused by, like, sexually abused by my mom, abused by male ministers. So it's like, I just want to be in it, leave anything sexually alone. But for me, also, there was compulsive masturbation because the only sex I knew was the abuse. So I wouldn't relive the abuse. So, I mean, in that aspect, fine. I still don't know, what does it mean to make amends to yourself? What does that mean? How do you do that?
Okay, so if you look in Step Into Action, I can't quote it to you, but there's a part in there.
It's
a paragraph that Margo wrote.
Is that the new book?
About things that, yeah, I mean, about things that I can do for myself.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, just one time you were sitting in the first row. You know, I mean, part of why I take care of myself in the church. Some of the
you know what?
I've noticed that overextending and taking care of others.
Oh, I do that all the time. That's my job.
So, well, yeah, I was in the
Northeast.
So we are codependent. Meaning that we get our jollies. We get our by taking care of others.
You know what I mean?
Oh, now I feel better. You feel better.
I work for you.
So I really well. I get close to my back. I get sleep. Never.